before we even get to Bernie Madoff, I wanted to ask you how you got into the world of financial journalism
and what that
world looked like for you.
Yeah, that's actually a very good question because it wasn't what I set out to do at all. I spent the first decade or so, dozen years of my career as a government reporter, covering local, county, and then state government here in New Jersey for first a weekly paper and then a small daily paper and then a larger daily paper. And that was really what I expected to do. In the last of those government reporting jobs, though, I stumbled across a scandal, got a tip, the phone rings, somebody tells you something you don't understand, but it sounds like it could be important. And it was a scandal wrapped around the state agency, the Independent Revenue Bond Authority, that financed low interest mortgages for multifamily housing, the New Jersey Housing Finance Agency. Now, these revenue bond authorities were being created willy-nilly at that point in time, which was around early 80s, 81, 80, 81. They were the new shiny toy in government. If you couldn't get the politicians to agree to do something, create a revenue bond authority and put a bunch of corporate types on it, sell municipal bonds on Wall Street, and then use the money to do what you want to do. So these were still pretty new critters for those of us in the government coverage world. And I'd never encountered one before. So when this tip came in that there was all sorts of cronyism going on in the awarding of these mortgages and the federal subsidies that let the mortgage holder, the mortgagees pay it off, I educated myself about that world enough to pursue this story. And I became a bag lady on the HFA for 2 years. People just hated seeing me coming because that was all I was obsessed with and all I was focused on. But it had a tremendous impact. The stories I did resulted in criminal prosecutions and convictions, in an overhaul of the Housing Finance Agency itself. I established, in New Jersey at least, the legal proposition that these agencies are governed by the Sunshine Act. They are required to hold open meetings and they are required to make their records open because I was the first person to ask to see them and they told me no. But the Attorney General of the state served on that board and he said, oh, what? Yes, you have to let her see the records. So it was very... It was an impactful investigation and a white collar crime investigation, which little did I know at the time was going to be my entire future. But what it did for me more than the achievements or more than the reactions that I've just outlined, I fell in love with the bond market. I mean, I had to learn enough about it to navigate the story. How municipal bonds were sold. I had to master the documents that were issued to bondholders. I had to understand all the fine print in those documents. I had to understand what role underwriters played in these transactions, what role credit rating agencies played in these transactions. Everybody loved the New Jersey Housing Finance Agency. It had a fabulous credit rating because no one knew what I knew about it. And once those stories started to run, they pulled up their socks really fast because of the risk to their credit rating and the risk, therefore, to the value of their bonds. And I slowly began to understand the extent to which public policy, the limits of the possible for public policy are determined in the financial markets. Mm. They're determined by the creditors of public agencies and public governments. The governor of New York State may want to do something. His legislators of the opposite party may not want to do it. what they're going to wind up doing is what will not hurt their credit rating. So the reliance on governments, the reliance of governments on the municipal bond market was the great revelation of this story for me. And I just wanted to know everything I could learn about the municipal bond market. At the time, I thought of it as public finance. You know, this was still covering government. This just was a way that government financed itself in these new revenue bond authority creatures. I didn't yet think of myself as a finance reporter. I was still trying to translate the municipal bond market into government policies and into how local governments worked and how that happened. So I had the opportunity to spend a year at the Woodrow Wilson School, what was then the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University, on a Guggenheim grant that let me consolidate my knowledge about revenue bond agencies, about municipal bond markets. I was hired then by the Philadelphia Inquirer as a business reporter. I went on their business staff. That was in 1982, and that was the big transition for me into business reporting. I never looked back.
So you joined the New York Times at what point?
Not until 1989.
Yeah, and that's exactly where you started with Bernie Madoff, right?
Uh-huh.
I wanted to ask you what the events were that led you and Bernie Madoff to intersect paths. And in addition to that, sort of explaining who Bernie Madoff was in the first place and what he did that really defined his legacy.
What made him so fascinating to me is really, this was a real life Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde story. The Bernie Madoff I first met, the Bernie Madoff I first heard about and knew about, was not the guy that ran the world's biggest Ponzi scheme. It was the guy that helped start the NASDAQ market in 1971 when it was a dream in some computer engineer's eyes. It was the guy that helped pull the NASDAQ market back together again after the meltdown of the 1987 crash, when people couldn't even get their phones answered. He helped write the post-crash rule book for NASDAQ. He pioneered the after-hours trading of listed stocks, what became known as the third market, which was the precursor for 24-hour trading. I have to remind you, there was a time in this country's life when stock exchanges closed. Mm-hmm. They would close at 4:30 and they wouldn't open again until 9:30 or 10:30 the next day. And when it was closed, those stocks traditionally didn't trade. You know, the trading day is over. We stopped trading these stocks. Bernie pioneered the round the clock trading of those stocks. He could start trading NYSE stocks the minute the closing bell rang. His traders would trade them with traders around the time zones, all around the world, until they came back to opening bell in New York the next day. So if news broke after hours, war breaks out in the Middle East, or there's an explosion at a refinery in Texas, and some brilliant editor says, you know, we got to get something in that about how the oil sector is going to be affected tomorrow. Got to get that in tomorrow's story. Well, the stocks are closed. I mean, this is 7:30 at night. The stock exchange has been closed for 3 hours. How am I supposed to find that out? I'm going to call Bernie Madoff's trading desk. Because Madoff and two other small firms, whom you also would call, were trading those stocks. As that news broke, they were trading those stocks. And they would tell you what the latest trades were. So it was reporters came to rely on these so-called third market firms to track the trading of stocks around the globe. So if we had a story or an AP report goes out ahead of the markets open saying, you know, it looks like it's going to be a pretty strong day, that's because the guys that were trading those shares in the past hour are seeing shares start to rise. before the exchange opened. So we came to rely on Madoff as one of the innovators there. Then there came the 90s. And in the 90s, Wall Street completely reinvented itself through computers, through the privatization of the stock markets. They became for-profit companies with all the conflicts and problems that produced. Computers were radically changing the way the stock market worked. And Bernie understood that. And better than that, Bernie could explain that to people who didn't understand that. He had a gift for translation. He could translate the increasingly complex and arcane and technical elements of how markets worked into language that lay people, read journalists, could understand. And I was covering these market structure changes for the Times as part of my regulatory beat. This was an intense regulatory pushing match. I mean, you know, the business was moving faster than regulators were and faster than regulators wanted it to move. And there was a lot of pushing and shoving over how to adapt to these new worlds. And that was my story. So at conferences, at panel discussions, there was Bernie explaining it all to us. So that was the Bernie in my Rolodex. That was the Bernie I knew. This was the guy that was an innovator. He was in the vanguard of market changes that became permanent and systemic changes. He started trading big board stocks around the clock. Then everybody was trading big board stocks around the clock. He started paying large retail brokerage firms and mutual funds for their order flow. He would pay them to send their orders to him. Now everybody pays for order flow. That's part of the income that that retail investment banks have. He always had the cutting edge trading technology, the software. That software that still had value even after his fraud was discovered and his company was put into bankruptcy. That software automation was sold by the trustee for money that went to help compensate victims. So that was the Dr. Jekyll of Madoff's life. That was the man he was proud of being. And that was the man I knew on the day that he was arrested. So I recognized when the news came across into our inbox from the SEC that Madoff had been arrested, I remembered who he was. Now, he was not a retail market guy. In fact, Jules Krull, the famous corporate gumshoe who founded the corporate intelligence detective business, Jules told me later that when he heard that Madoff had been arrested, he called some buddies of his in investment banking. None of them had ever heard of Bernie Madoff, which made perfect sense, he said, because Bernie had nothing to do with the red suspender, black car investment banking world of the 80s and the 90s. That was not his world. One of them called down to his trading desk and said, "Have you ever heard of Bernie Madoff?" "Oh my God, what do you mean he's been arrested?" Everybody on the trading desk knew Bernie Madoff because he had revolutionized how Wall Street trading worked. He was a giant in their world. Everybody knew the Madoff trading firm. It was a wholesale firm. It didn't do business with retail customers, we thought. But the insiders knew him, the people who maintained the plumbing backstage and kept everything moving backstage, they all knew Bernie. So I remembered him. He wasn't a household name, but I remembered his prominence in that world of how markets worked, and ran up to my editor at the time, Larry Ingrassia, and said, "You know, this guy Bernie Madoff has just been arrested." I had checked with a regulatory source, to get an idea of the scale of the fraud, the scale of the case, and was told that it was huge. And then the guy hung up on me. Huge. So I ran up to my editor and said, I think it's big. I think, and he's an important figure on Wall Street. He's, you know, been an advisor to regulators. He's testified at congressional hearings. He's a big deal. And so they said, fine, go for it. And that was the first page one story. And as journalists know, as I'm sure you know, the first byline on a story has a huge advantage because tips flow to that byline. You know, your name is on the story. Anybody who knows anything about Madoff that night reads that story, calls you the next morning, sends you an email, sends you a snail mail tip in the mail. We got some of those. So I had a big advantage having been first on the story to stay on the story and continue to lead our coverage of the story through the 9 months that followed that were just a nightmare for his investors and a fascinating story for me. He was arrested in December. He went to prison down in North Carolina in June. And you know, I was fascinated by the story. In the spring of 2009, I was offered a book contract to write about the Madoff scandal on the basis of the work I'd done in the Times. And with the Times permission required under our code of ethics, with the Times permission, I agreed, I accepted the book offer. And the reason they require that is just to have a second, you know, once I'm doing a book about the story, I could have a vested stake in making it a bigger story, in making it a longer story, making it a story that lasts further into the future. Mm-hmm. But once I had signed the book contract, another set of eyes always came in to decide. If I said, I think I should write this tomorrow, what do you think? And that editor would look at what else had been written, decide whether it was an incremental story that was important enough to run or not. Occasionally some stories were spiked. I thought they were important, editor didn't. But someone was always looking over my shoulder from that point on to be sure I wasn't hyping my own book by hyping the story for the Times, which is kind of absurd when you think about it. This was front page news in every newspaper around the world.
Yeah.
It was global because his victims were global. So we didn't really worry too much for the first 9 months about overhyping the story. After that, I really tried to you know, make sure I didn't try to pitch a story that really didn't have a very valid reason to run. So that's how I got the book contract. That's how I got to work on the book. And that's why I kept nagging Bernie to talk to me while he was.
But why did he talk to you?
Oh, gosh. You know, in my worst nightmares, I imagine that he decided to talk to me because he thought I would be the most gullible reporter he could talk to. You know, this is a con man. You know, you don't want to be the guy that the con man thinks he can con, or the gal that the con man thinks he can con. But I don't think, based on our interactions over the years and that first interview in August of, that would have been 2010, just 2 months before the book was due. I mean, I'd already finished the book. I had a completed draft that I had to radically rewrite after this interview. But we stayed in touch. I last spoke to him maybe 6 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago by phone, stayed in touch, emails and letters over those years. And I think it was that he felt like I knew his world. You know, He knew that I knew what he'd done. I mean, I knew the Bernie Madoff he was proud of being. I knew that part of him. So I could assure him that that was part of my story too. And indeed it was. I mean, that's part of the drama of this story. How did Dr. Jekyll become Mr. Hyde? How did he live those two lives parallel to one another for so many years? So obviously the contrast meant I had to tell the story about the good Bernie to make the contrast with the bad Bernie. Mm. And if you go back and analyze the previous books and the previous coverage of Bernie, you don't see that in most of that coverage. You don't see the historical perspective of how Bernie came to be. And as a result, too many journalists failed to understand why he was trusted so much. So you saw journalists saying, well, people should have known this was too good to be true. He was a con artist. Why would anybody believe Bernie Madoff? Well, if you didn't know who this man had been for 30 years on Wall Street, then you couldn't put yourself in the shoes of his investors. You know, these were not greedy people who just, you know, walked up to some flashy charlatan on the street corner and gave them their money. These were people who thought they were dealing with one of the most credible men on the street. There was a big price fixing scandal. Again, this is where having covered the street for so long was a huge plus for me on this story. In 1998, there was a big price fixing scandal in the NASDAQ market. And 28 major firms, Prudential, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, everybody wound up settling a Justice Department civil action for nearly $1 billion in damages, which in 1998 was real money. They had been fixing the spreads. There was a conspiracy among the trading desks, all these NASDAQ traders, and they were caught on recorded telephone lines enforcing this conspiracy. Do not sell a NASDAQ stock for less than a quarter of a point above what you bought it for. So they were fixing a minimum spread. Huge scandal, front page news, went on right through Christmas of 1998. Who wasn't sued? Who was not a defendant in that case? Oh, only one of the biggest NASDAQ traders on the street. Bernie Madoff was conspicuous by his absence from that list of defendants.
Hmm.
Now, in hindsight, we can say, well, he was running a fraud downstairs. Of course, he didn't want investigators coming to look at his trading desk. But the fact was, he ran a spotless, legitimate firm. Absolutely squeaky clean. And in January of 1999, if you're a regulator in Washington and you've just watched 28 of the largest firms on Wall Street settle for $1 billion with the Justice Department for running a long, extensive, market-wide price-fixing scandal, and Bernie Madoff was not in it, he's the only honest trader on the street, right? Everybody else has admitted that their trading desk was crooked. His was not.
Hmm.
So that was part of why he was trusted so much. And if you didn't know that, you couldn't understand why regulators didn't catch him. You know, he had demonstrated his honesty to them in this price fixing scandal. So when people tried to blow the whistle on it, when people tried to raise doubts about him, regulators gave him the benefit of the doubt because they knew him to be an honest man based on that price fixing scandal he had avoided. So the market history, the history shaped the way you covered what was happening that day. And that, to me, if I've got an ace in the hole as a journalist, that's it. I study the minutes of the last meeting. I make sure that I know the history of the marketplace because it shapes how you cover what's happening now.
Mm-hmm. Can you paint a picture of what it was like to sit across from him in prison? What did the room look like? What did it feel like to you?
almost exactly like it was portrayed in the HBO dramatization of the book. They consulted me closely on those details. The only difference was, instead of having a lovely real table in the visiting room, well, let me start at the beginning. So we arrived, I had to meet Ike Sorkin, Bernie's lawyer, in the lobby of the prison down in Butner, North Carolina. I had had heart palpitations all night because I got in that night before. Ike was going to fly down that morning. There was a terrible thunderstorm, and I was certain Ike didn't make it. I didn't hear from him. I'd left voicemail messages saying, call me when you arrive. But fortunately, he was in the lobby when I arrived. We put all our belongings into a locker. I was allowed to take in a legal pad and a pen and a sheet of paper with my questions on it. That was it. No tape recorder, no camera, no phone, no nothing. That was it.
Really?
Old-fashioned journalism. So, pad and a pen. And there's an airlock security system you go through. At first they, you empty your pockets. I didn't have anything. I didn't have pockets. Ike did, so he emptied his pockets. And we go through the metal detector. We go into an airlock. The doors lock behind us. We get a little stamp on our hand. The doors open into the hallway. And right off that hallway is the visitor room. As I'm entering the visitor room here, I look down the hallway past the security screen, and Bernie's coming in from the prisoner entrance. I'm coming in from the public entrance. He's coming in from the visitor entrance. A little old guy in a khaki prison uniform. Just, you'd have passed him on the street without ever looking twice. Just a little old guy in a prison uniform. We enter the room. It's not visitor day, so we're the only people there. It is dimly lit. They don't have the overhead fluorescents on. The only light is really coming from the window that's right beside us and the vending machines across the back of the room, which are all lit. You know, they have shiny lights. So the vending machine lights are coming. There's a raised dais in the far back corner where one of the guards sits and observes the meeting. Bernie had to sit facing him. The tables and chairs were all cheap plastic patio furniture, the kind that stacks up, you know? Well, they're low coffee table size tables and, you know, plastic little stackable armchairs. Ike had to gather three of those tables and stack them up so we could get a normal height table for me to write on. And we sat in the light of the window so I could get enough light. I was in the middle. Ike was to my right. Bernie was to my left. I had a deal with Ike that the entire, that if there was anything in the conversation that he felt had to be off the record for Bernie's own legal protection or whatever, he could tell me at the end of the interview and I would agree to take it off the record. Now, this was an unusual arrangement, but I only had 2 hours. And I did not want to litigate issues of on the record, off the record, in the 2 hours I had Bernie. I'm going to have Ike the rest of the afternoon. We can go through and argue about whether something should or should not be on the record. But Ike promised he would not say a word, but he would just take notes. And if there was anything that was said that he wanted to argue with about later, we could discuss it. As it turned out, he had no disputes with anything, but he was sworn to silence for the course of this interview. Bernie came in. I was uncertain about whether I would be allowed to shake hands with him or not. He extended and then kind of pulled it back. And so I had stuff to hold. I finessed that. And he had taken some notes. He took a piece of three-ring composition paper out of his pocket and had written some notes. And these were points I'm sure he wanted to make. But I never knew what those notes had to say. He was very dapperly dressed. I mean, a very dapper, crisp ironed uniform, shiny brass belt buckle. His black leather sneakers mm-hmm. were shined, polished and shined, which was quite in keeping. He was a dandy in real life. I mean, we've seen the stories about his gorgeous closet with all the suits lined up, and they were Savile Row handmade suits. So he loved to look good, and he looked as crisp as a prisoner's uniform can look. And we talked for 2 hours. And I'm taking handwritten notes, which was I came of age before you had a tape recorder sitting on every phone. You didn't have a phone. I came of age in an age when if the verdict came in, you raced to the payphone in the lobby of the courthouse to get there before your competitors did, with bunches of quarters in your hand. Mm-hmm. So I had never lost my note-taking skills, thank goodness, because I had to rely solely on those that day.
Yeah.
Just turning my mind into a movie camera that was mm-hmm. taking down everything. And when we were done, Ike wanted to chit-chat. The warden wanted to chit-chat. The deputy warden who had escorted me wanted to chit-chat. And I just was terribly rude to them. I said, I'm sorry, I can't talk to anybody. I've got to go over these notes. And I left, sat in my rental car out in the parking lot and reread everything I'd written, remembering, making sure I could understand what my scribbled notes were, and reviewed the entire interview in my head to be sure I'd gotten it correct. And that was the first interview with him. We exchanged letters and emails thereafter. And I was able to interview him a second time in February of 2011. Now the book was almost ready to come out by that mm-hmm. point. I think I interviewed him right after Valentine's Day, maybe. And the last time I could change so much as a semicolon in the text of the book was the end of February. So there was this tiny window in which only space neutral changes could be made in the galleys. They were about ready to run the print mm-hmm. press on that book. So I went down for the second yeah. interview. Now I'd been asking for a second interview for months and months and months. This was the first date the Bureau of Prisons would approve. So it wasn't my idea to come there 2 weeks before my drop dead deadline. But that was as soon as they would let me in. And that was about 2 months after Madoff's son had killed himself. And I mentioned the details about Bernie's appearance because when I saw him in February, he was a wreck.
A person murders somebody and they get 25 years, a life sentence, right? Or something. Let's just give that as an example. Mm-hmm. Bernie committed a corporate crime and he received a 150-year sentence. So what does that say about the American justice system, that is what happened? I'm just asking I'm just curious.
Yeah. Well, Judge Chin, who imposed that sentence, described it as a symbolic sentence, a sentence that recognized the vast damage Madoff had done to tens of thousands of people. You called it a corporate crime. Mm-mm. These were individual lives that were destroyed. Two investors that killed themselves when they learned of their losses. A British soldier who had lost everything in the Viennese feeder fund, and a French money manager who had put all his friends' money into Madoff, killed himself. So two suicides that we know of. Elderly Holocaust survivors, elderly family patriarchs who had put all the family's money with Madoff. And not only were they broke, their kids were broke, their grandkids were broke. Kids had to drop out of college because the tuition money had gone up in smoke, the money they expected to be able to pay. Family homes had to be sold that they expected to live in forever. So lives were destroyed by this crime. A Ponzi scheme is a vicious personal crime. You don't realize you're being held up by knife point until the knife goes in. But it is not a corporate crime. This isn't embezzling money from a giant corporation. This is taking money out of people's lives. And at least 20% of the Madoff victims had claims of less than $1 million, but it was all they had. So one out of five were modest investors who lost everything, all their retirement savings. There are 85-year-old investors. I heard from the day Bernie died, obviously the obit runs, and people who still kept my email reached out to me. One of them was an 85-year-old who was still working full-time because he had lost his entire, and was still furious at Madoff, felt personally damaged by Madoff. So there was that. There was the vast personal harm, which his victims had testified to in the pre-sentencing reports. And then there was the times. There was the moment in financial history that we were in at that point. This is not even 6 months, 9 months after the Lehman Brothers weekend. And in the 9 months since that meltdown, September 15, 2008, the economy had gone into an absolute tailspin. Tens of thousands, if not millions of people had lost their jobs. People had discovered that all of these mortgage-backed securities that they put into their retirement funds were crap. And that some of the people who sold it to them knew they were crap. So The entire country felt betrayed by a recklessly indifferent Wall Street. Bernie became the face of that betrayal.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask is, you know, how many of those investment firms and bank executives and also, you know, government officials have been held responsible for the massive losses and misrepresentations of defaulted investments during the credit crisis, you know, in 2008?
Too few. And so in a way, it was unfair to hold Madoff as the poster child of a recklessly reckless and selfish and Wall Street indifferent to the harm it was doing. He was reckless, he was selfish, and he was indifferent to the harm that he was doing, but he had nothing to do with the meltdown. Mind you, his fraud had survived several previous meltdowns. It almost survived this one. So he had nothing to do with the actual events that brought Wall Street nearly brought our financial system down in 2008. He was innocent of that specific crime, but he inherited the rage. He inherited the fury that was just kind of free-floating among the American public. And as it happens, when a Ponzi scheme falls apart, it's pretty easy to prove that it was a Ponzi scheme. Unlike some of the instances that you mentioned, badly structured mortgage-backed securities, harder to prove that that's a crime. Being stupid is not a crime. And there were a lot of stupid people on Wall Street who took a lot of risks they shouldn't have taken, but it's hard to put that before a jury. And in fact, prosecutors tried to prosecute the Mac Parabaugh fund managers, two hedge fund managers who had invested in mortgage-backed securities and taken a huge loss. And a criminal prosecution was brought against them, and they were acquitted. So the Justice Department didn't have a lot of confidence in its ability to bring criminal cases that juries would accept. There was no question that Bernie Madoff was guilty, guilty, guilty. So in a way, he became a lightning rod for all that anger that nobody else was going to pay for. Hence, 150-year sentence. Say Bernie was arrested and nothing else had happened. Lehman Brothers hadn't failed. The auto industry wasn't circling the drain. The money market funds hadn't melted down. The Fed didn't have to rescue five of the investment banks on Wall Street. None of that had happened. All that had happened was on December 11th, Bernie Madoff was arrested for running a gigantic, the largest ever Ponzi scheme. He's not going to get 5 years, but he's not going to get 150 years. He probably would have gotten 15 or 20, which means he would have died in prison just as he did. It would not have made any material difference to him. And I think, can't put words in the judge's, or thoughts in the judge's mind or words in his mouth, but possibly that was his consideration, that if he sentenced Madoff at the maximum, the prosecutors were requesting 20 years based on their calculation of the severity of his crime. His lawyer was pleading for 10 years, 8 to 10, maybe 12, okay, based on the history of white collar crimes, understanding he's going to be at the upper limit of those sentences. So I think Judge Chin knew he was going to be imposing a 20-year sentence on a 70-year-old guy. So it was, in effect, going to be a life sentence. Now, there's a chance that he might live longer, but nevertheless, it was likely going to be a life sentence. And the, as he said in his sentencing remarks, the damage that Madoff had done to society, the trust that he had destroyed in among the public had a cost, that you had to recognize that. So I think the 150-year sentence was symbolic, but it was based on an understanding that the practical effect of it would not be that different.
On the one hand, Bernie betrayed thousands of investors. And on the other hand, he betrays his family.
Yeah.
Did he ever express to you just how, what he was thinking in that? The fact that he held that lie for so many years towards them, and his wife even considering him her lifeline, even after the fact.
I honestly think, in part for the reasons I've just outlined with respect to the history of how white collar crime was addressed in the country, I think Bernie was completely blindsided by how his family was affected. I mean, he told me repeatedly that he had been so careful to keep his sons and his brother out of the fraud. I mean, he had it's almost like, you know, Andrew and Mark Madoff were Dr. Jekyll's sons, and Frank DiPasquale was Mr. Hyde's son down on the 17th floor, his lieutenant helping him run the fraud. And never the two shall meet. He was so convinced that he had protected his family from ever bearing any consequences from what he had done, which, you know, it makes no sense. It just, and I would tell him that. I said, Bernie, what if you'd been hit by a bus? That line in the movie was actually true, right from my interviews with him. I said, what if you've been walking down, you know, Lexington Avenue one day and you get hit by a bus? What was going to happen? And he said, oh, well, you know, Frank would have, you know, unwound everything. I mean, he would have, you know, he probably would have faced the music. I said, Bernie, your sons would have inherited the firm. That's the way your will was set up, right? Yes, your sons would have inherited the firm. And there's a fraud going on in the basement of the firm. You know, they were going to discover it, bear the responsibility for it. He absolutely refused to admit that he had ever put them at risk. And the way they put it in the script, and I didn't have the sense to ask this of Bernie in my real life interview. I said, you know, you let your family, your sons and your brother and your wife, you let your family build their lives on the top of an active volcano that only you knew was there. What were you thinking? That you'd be able to get them to safety when it looked like it was going to blow? I mean, you let them, I mean, Andrew wanted to leave the firm. He wanted to set off on his own. No, no, no. Dad wouldn't let him. He was always making fun of Peter. I mean, he, you know, Peter the nerd, Peter the computer jockey, you know, Peter the lawyer who got the law degree but wound up working for me who dropped out of law school. So he was always kind of scornful of Peter. And, you know, Ruth worshiped him. Mark worshiped him. How he thought they were going to get through the collapse of this fraud, God only knows. I was never able to get an adequate answer for him. But your question was, did he ever show remorse about that damage? And he absolutely did. It was the only sincere remorse I felt that he had expressed. His statement in the courtroom felt rehearsed and stilted. The comments he made to me in my interview felt rehearsed and stilted. He said the remorseful things about having, you know, stolen all this money and hurt all these people. And over the years, he backed away from that. You know, he, in subsequent emails or phone calls, he was saying, well, you know, they should have been grateful for the money they made on me all those years. They lived very nice lives thanks to me. You know, he started to express the contempt for his victims that every con man has, ultimately for his victims, started to express that more openly. But he was blindsided by the damage he did to his family. He hadn't expected them to suffer, and they suffered massively. Yeah. And he was utterly unprepared for that. And with good reason. You know, Ruth Madoff was given a harder time than John Gotti's wife was. I mean, there are mobsters' wives and sons who get less of a beating in the press than the Madoff family got. There was not a scintilla of evidence against any of those three people. And they were hounded within an inch of their lives and for Mark beyond that point of endurance. Yeah. So Bernie could never have predicted that. I didn't predict that because the long history of white collar crime, nobody followed Mike Milken's wife to the grocery store. I mean, nobody followed the WorldCom executives, Bernie Ebers' children around on their college campuses. That didn't happen. So Bernie had no reason to think it would be any different this time. I think he expected he would be pilloried. He would face the music, as he put it. He would face the music. And, you know, Ruth and his sons, and maybe his brother. Okay, maybe his brother would be in trouble because he worked for him. He was the legal compliance officer. Maybe he would have a little professional trouble, right? But he never dreamed that Ruth would become a pariah, that her hairdresser would fire her, that no one would rent her an apartment in New York City. He never dreamed that his family would suffer to the extent that they did. And Yes, it would have destroyed him if he hadn't been so incredibly adept at compartmentalizing the uncomfortable aspects of his life.
My final question to you is really just goes back to the whole coverage of this and why journalism is just so crucial, the role that it plays in covering this story, your journalism specifically, like what kind of an impact did it have?
Well, you know, this, I'm an investigative reporter. I mean, that was what I spent 80% of my career doing, was investigative reporting. And this was not investigative reporting. I came up with a few scoops, I dug up a few stories about deals that Wall Street banks had made with Bernie or with the feeder funds that hadn't been known and that didn't look good. But by and large, I was covering an unfolding story. I didn't write the story that led to Bernie being arrested. I simply covered a moving story. And was able to explain it, was able to put it in a context, and was able around the edges to do some what I was proud of in terms of investigative reporting about ancillary players who wound up making big settlements as a result. So it's not my mainline career work has been investigative reporting, where I uncover stuff and we mm-hmm. print it and someone goes to jail. I mean, so that's kind of what an investigative reporter dreams of doing, right? That wasn't this story. This story was someone else has uncovered something, in this case, the Suns and the FBI. And my job is to basically cover a breaking news story. So it was kind of back to my roots as a reporter. I mean, this is what I had done as a baby reporter, covered breaking news. And so that was what I was doing in telling the Madoff story. But I do think that the history I brought to it, the fact that I had been covering white collar criminals for so long, and I had been covering the market in which this particular white collar criminal had made his name and had committed his crime for so long, I think that certainly shaped how I covered the story. What effect did media coverage have? Well, we talked a little bit about it around the edges. The Madoff family overnight became libel proof. And the real test of journalism ethics is how you cover people who can't sue you for libel, because they have no reputation left to lose. Their father, their husband has destroyed their reputation. So they have no reputation left to lose. So you can really write anything you want to about them without fear of being held to account. Mm-hmm. And that happened. It was not the media's finest hour, how they covered the Madoff case. The number of news outlets that reported the imminent arrest of Mark and Andrew Madoff, at least five. The number of media outlets that reported the imminent arrest of Ruth Madoff, the exhilarating news that the FBI had seized her laptop computer from the office. And what did they find? Online shopping. That's what they found, was online shopping. So there was a sensationalism, a hyperbole to the way the scandal was covered with respect, especially to Mark, Andrew, and Ruth, that I felt I was pushing back against constantly. Some credible news outlet would report Madoff, that Mark and Andrew are about to be arrested. I'd get a call, at 11 o'clock at night from an editor. Do we need to match this? Do we need to chase this? And I would call the Sun's lawyer. And by the way, the simple fact that Mark and Andrew still had the same lawyer One lawyer, two potential defendants, violates every rule of ethics if they were under investigation.
Mm.
If they had genuinely been subjects or targets of a criminal investigation, the first thing that you would have seen was separate lawyers, because it might be in one brother's best interest to roll over on the other brother. Only separate lawyers could have adequately protected the interests of the individual sons. They didn't have separate lawyers. They had one lawyer representing them both,
mm-hmm.
which told me and everybody who knew anything about legal ethics that one of two things was true. That lawyer knew they were not facing any criminal investigation, was absolutely certain of it, or the prosecutors were lying to that lawyer about whether they were facing criminal investigation, mm-hmm. which could have gotten them disbarred.
Right.
Okay. So you do the math in your head. What are the odds that Mark and Andrew are about to be arrested? Nil, zero, zilch. They would have separate lawyers by now if that were mm-hmm. the case. But it was a constant pushback against wild, wild stories mm-hmm. That you just exceeded. Well, I mean, one very well-known TV guy referred to them as an organized crime family, likened Bernie and Ruth to Bonnie and Clyde.
Mm.
So that was part of what I was up against. And I think it's a good journalistic lesson to know that you can never predict when your moral compass is going to get hit with magnetic waves. You can never predict. I never would have predicted that on this story, I was going to be confronting the kind of ethical issues that I did confront in trying to make sure that our coverage was fair to every member of the Madoff family, that the Times coverage was fair. And I think it was. I can look back and say it absolutely was. And I have to think that that's at least part of the reason that Bernie agreed to talk with me and not to the 15 other journalists from 15 other publications that were trying to get him to talk to them. I know he had followed our coverage. I knew that from things he'd said. And I felt that he would have felt we were fair to his family. It was a disappointing time for me in some ways as a journalist. I was disappointed that my profession didn't stand up better to the forces of the time, didn't push back more against this mob of, you know, pitchforks and torches that was going after the Madoff family. But you know, it's useful to remember times like that. To remember, you know, when the pitchforks and torches are out, that's when we need to be most careful that we are being fair to people who don't have a prayer of suing us if we're not.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's on us. Lots of times you're fair because the penalties of not being fair are you get sued, or you know, you have to run a correction or you have to run a clarification or you get angry, nasty looks in the cafeteria. I mean, there are lots of hard and soft ways that reinforce the notion that we've got to try to be fair to the people we cover. But when those people have no chance of protesting, when, you know, they don't have a prayer of ever collecting, that's when you find out who's swimming naked in the ethics department. That's when you find out who really walks the walk. When you can write anything you want to about Ruth Madoff, what do you write? When you can listen to any conspiratorial FBI gossip you want to about the sons, do you print it? Some people did, and I didn't, so. It was a tough call. There was a lot of pressure to get to break news on Bernie. There was a lot of pressure to get out in front of the investigation. And it was a little moral pop quiz that none of us saw coming.
Diana Henriquez, I really appreciate your time. I look forward to reading more of your journalism and reading that upcoming book.
I've enjoyed our conversation, Ziv. Thank you for thinking of me and reaching out to me.